Okay, so good morning. So this is supposed to be an informal talk, right? So I prepared 100 slides. And I'm here, I mean, I think the tradition is that you can't get through the first 10, but I hope we can get through the first 10. Anyway, so I thought I would do, you know, seismology, of course, is not something that will be done on exoplanets anytime soon, at least not the same kind of seismology that we do on Earth. So I thought I would start with some, you know, a little bit of historical background on what seismology brought to the study of the Earth's interior, and then go on to talk a little bit about what we've learned about the Moon and what we might learn about Mars if I ever get there. Okay, so this is just a summary slide. Zooming through all the way through the 19th century. So the big question, of course, is what is planet differentiated? And there were lots of discussions until the 19th century and through the 19th century about whether the interior of the Earth is entirely solid or fluid or a combination of it. There were notions before the 19th century that the Earth might have a fluid core. In fact, Edmund Halley proposed that to explain the magnetic field, you might need a solid magnet inside a fluid envelope, inside a solid crust. So that was at the turn of the 18th century. But in the 19th century, this idea that there was a fluid part inside the Earth became a big debate when different physicists tried to reconcile data from the shape of the Earth, the nutations and precessions, and also the idea of cooling of the Earth through time. And the big debate was whether the Earth interior was on which side of the melting curve the Earth interior was, and of course this had to do with what it was made of. So I so there were these debates about what the thickness of the solid shell should be or shouldn't be, and I just zoom down here to really the end of the 19th century, just before the start of seismological investigations, when, in fact, Wishart, I think, is an important step when he, first of all, noted that the mean density of the Earth is larger than the rocks at the surface, so the Earth cannot be made entirely of rocks. And here the important idea is that this couldn't be done with a continuous increase in density as the pressure increases, but really with the idea that it would be a two-shell body with an internal shell made of a different composition. And by comparison with the meteorites, which is of course the modern way of also discussing the core, he suggested that the core may be made of iron and nickel.
A reliable ratio I over m squared of the pyramid, because that's a
Yes. So this was a part of these computations. I mean, the Chandler wobble and the precession mutations gave an idea of the moment of inertia, and therefore you could do two-layer models. Correct me if I have something wrong.
No, just a question. The mean density is 5.5, which is higher than the density of the rocks, but
yes.
Compressed rocks are sometimes higher.
Yes. So this is why this is remarkable, is that he proposed that you couldn't just continuously increase density with the rock density that you needed. You needed to have a boundary with a different composition,
denser composition. By the way, I don't know if you made this slide up recently, but Aren't those densities three orders of magnitude
yes.
off?
Yes, okay. I didn't make it wrench. I made it recently as an hour ago.
That explains it.
Sorry. Okay, we'll correct this. Okay, so we date the birth of seismology, of global seismology, to von Reuber-Paschwitz, 1889, who was actually studying the solid tides to kind of get some information about the rigidity of the Earth. And he observed this disturbance on a pendulum at Potsdam in 1889, and another one in another location in Germany. And from connecting this with what he read in a newspaper, I guess in Nature actually, about the occurrence of an earthquake in Japan on the same day about the same time, he made the connection, oh, so these are seismic waves that went through the Earth, and we can observe the effect of distant earthquakes from the propagation of seismic waves.
Wait, he deduced that an earthquake
yes,
in
so
Japan was felt in Poland?
In Germany, yes.
In Germany, possibly. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, that is right. So he saw this, and then he read in the paper. Of course, they didn't have internet, so whatever. It took him a couple of days, right?
That's amazing.
June. It, from April 17th to June 13th. Right?
Wow.
So that's the birth of global seismology, and then things went very fast, and so I have this summary slides, right, about figuring out what the core of the Earth is. So discovery of the liquid core. By the time I'm going to say a few more words about it. Inge Lehmann discovers the inner core in 1936. Then the suggestion that the inner core is solid, because her original suggestion just indicated there was a layering, but it didn't prove that there was solidity. He suggests this, that it corresponds to solidification of iron. This is sort of a side interesting comment. Boulen suggests that if the inner core is solid, we should observe PKJKP waves. These are waves that are compressional waves in the mantle and the outer core, and shear waves in the inner core, right, which is a measure of solidity. And in 1970, confirmation of the solidity of the inner core by Adam Jawinski, sitting here in the front row. and then further along, more discoveries in more recent times. So this is from Oldham, so 1906. He was plotting these travel time curves, so the time it takes for P waves and S waves to travel as a function of the distance measured in degrees of arc along the surface of the Earth. And he noticed this jump here. So this is P and S. And at this distance of about 120 some degrees, and deduced that this is basically the manifestation that you lose the S waves, so you encounter a liquid part of the Earth. And that's really the sketch which this is for P waves and this is for S waves, right? So shear waves stop at some distance and you don't see them anymore. Afterwards, you see the waves that start as shear waves in the mantle, then go through the core as compressional waves, and then go back as shear waves, which is, of course, which is why you see some S energy at larger distances. And for P waves, you also have a shadow zone where the waves, as they start diffracting around the core, some energy dives into the core where the velocity is lower than the mantle, and so and then until you interact with the inner core, you basically the rays follow these paths that create a shadow in the.
Is
So that previous figure is what they're doing, compiling many different events from different locations?
Yes, right. Different events, different stations. And at the beginning, of course, things were difficult, but you know, because you have to also locate the earthquakes, right? You know where they are, and you have to estimate the velocities of the shear and compression of waves. So the problem of figuring out the earth structure and location of the source is tightly coupled. Okay, so 1910, then, this is what we had as a representation of the Earth. Then came Inge Lehmann. She basically observed P-type, so compressional type phases in the shadow of the core. And she calls this new phase P-prime, and she writes a paper, the shortest title, P-prime. this is what we call PKP now, these phases. And so she provided evidence for a region at the center of the core with a different elastic properties than the external part of the core.
And this is,
yes.
Just as, because where you're going, I'm guessing you're going to go. A lot of this wouldn't really have been possible to do if it weren't for the fact that the radial velocity differences are bigger than the horizontal, right?
You mean that the compression wave velocities are bigger
even,
than
even the S. I mean the fact that the variations in the radial are so much bigger.
Oh, you mean that the velocities vary very quickly with depth,
yeah.
increase
right.
with depth in the mantle.
If they were about equal, it would really have been hard to.
Well, okay.
Do this,
so look at this. This is her. I don't know if this is really the question you're asking. She traced straight rays in the mantle, so like as if the velocity was constant, right? And that's really, you know, that was the reasoning. This is her paper. This is a figure in her paper. And she observed these phases in the shadow here, which turned out to be the, you know, reflected mostly phases on the inner core boundary, observed in the shadow. But from this, you can't tell that the core, inner core is solid, right? You can tell that you have a boundary, a sharp increase in P velocity. This is a morph here. But yes, so, and in fact, this is a standard exercise that we give to students. You know, if you give a velocity in the mantle and a velocity in the core, and you ask them to trace ray and figure out shadow zones, etc. So this is now a more complete picture of body wave, P wave kind of travel, how P waves travel through the core. So once you get to interact with the core, you have a diffracted wave that goes here, and then you have waves that dive into the core due to the velocity reduction, and then some of them do not interact with the inner core and reappear at large distances. Some of them then interact with the inner core and either reflect. This is not showing the reflection, actually. Well, yes, I guess. I don't know what. And this is the F layer. This is a famous layer which is at the top of the inner core, which is likely has some slight different properties. It must be Bolt's paper, yes. Okay, so anyway, just more ray tracing, just to show the shadow zone and the triplication in the core with these phases being the main body wave phases that we study for to learn about the structure of the core and the inner core. And just this for curiosity, the other phases that you can observe, these phases that bounce around the core from the interior, which are called PNKP. And here are some observations. They take a long time, but you can see them. Of course, today, we have, yes.
Looking at this graph, how strong is the damping of these waves? So how frequently could they go around, or bounce around in the core?
Well, actually, I think They've been observed up to at least P9 kp. So, the damping is the strongest in the mantle. But once you get into the core, the bulk attenuation in the core is very small. So they bounce. So the attenuation comes from the reflection coefficient of the core mantle boundary, which is strong because the contrast is large. So yes, I mean they're faint, but they are observable quite far. What is not clear up to today, this is a phase, a mysterious phase, because you observe it in some cases and in some other cases you don't. I mean, there are the distribution of observations is not very well understood, and it may have to do with topography on the core mantle boundary that may defocus or focus this way. So today we have many observations, right? And so we can do a lot of different things with waveforms and travel time observations. I just wanted to show you this is a stack. So this is as a function of distance, again, angular distance. So this is between 80 and 180, which is the antipode of the earthquake. What's done here, it's taking transverse component. So transverse component will be, you'll see mostly shear energy on these components. And this is many different stations, many different earthquakes, and they've been aligned on a wave which bounces off the surface once. So it's called SS, like this. And as a function of distance, so you have a lot of energy here corresponding to this arrival, and they've switched polarities as necessary in order to enhance the similarity of the signals. And then you can see in advance of these arrivals, you see other energy arrivals very clearly, which actually correspond to waves reflected from the bottom of the upper mantle discontinuity. So the upper mantle discontinuities have been discovered previously with other types of observations, but this kind of stack, which we can do now, it's very easy to do with the number of observations that exist, really confirm the observation of these phases that interact with the upper mantle boundaries, which correspond to phase changes in the olivine system, mineralogical system. And then you can see other, this is an interpretation of this, you can see these other phases that also correspond to interactions with the discontinuities. Here you see the wave that bounces off twice from the core mantle boundary, arriving here with a different slowness. Okay, so we can do this. But let's go back. Now, I'm going to go back and forth. So an important first step was, that basically seismology gives you velocities, essentially, of shear and compression of waves, sometimes density. I'll talk about it a little later. But then you have to confront this with mineral physics information, and this is famous work by Francis Birch, who, by confronting with what was known from mineral physics, demonstrated the nature, the silicate nature of the mantle and the iron kind of nature of the core, and also the fact that the core is 10%. Is because the core is 10% less dense than pure iron, that it contains some portion of light elements. And so this is not from the times of Birch, but still a relatively old slide, just illustrating the density of pure iron compared to at room temperature, at high temperature, and then compared to a reference Earth model here in the outer core and then the inner core, showing the that the inner core is a would be more pure iron than the outer core. Okay, so the other type of observations that I haven't talked about are Earth sphere oscillations. So the P and the S waves are relatively short period waves. They're about P waves typically 1 second period. The S waves 10 to 30 seconds periods. The body waves, the energy travels through the interior of the Earth. But we also have surface waves, so waves that travel around the Earth whose energy decays with depth. And this is an example of a record, a long record. So this is like 15 hours of record for a large earthquake, magnitude 6.8, observed at a distance of about 110 degrees. And you can see these arrivals of energy progressively decaying due to the fact that the Earth is not purely elastic. And they correspond to this. The source would be here. And the station here, this would be the first arriving Rayleigh wave trends, Rayleigh waves observed on the vertical component. And then this second one goes around the other way, and then the third one. So all the odd ones are going in the same direction and traveling multiple times around the Earth. Yes?
You've chosen station C and B just to puzzle us, or?
Yes. C and B is a station here in California, actually. Yes. Northern California. One part of the Berkeley network.
So why isn't there a way that doesn't go in the plane of your slide, but
in the plane of
the slide? So you show R1 going in the plane of the slide.
This is the vertical plane, right?
R2
that contains the center of the Earth, the source and the station.
So why aren't there waves that go around?
Oh, because, okay. So depending on the period, they are sensitive to a broader range. But this is the shortest path between the source and the station. So this is the preferred path. In a 1D Earth, and at relatively long period, short periods, the waves will concentrate, the paths along the great circle paths.
So there actually are waves in the directions, but somehow they don't add
so the source radiates in all directions, right? But if you are at a particular station, most of the energy that the station sees has propagated along the great circle paths.
So that's like where they add coherently? Or?
It's just, I guess, what is it?
Well, if you have another station, let's say C and B is where these arrows meet, but if you had another station, you would make a different cross section and it would be...
Yes, but so he's asking why this propagates along the great circle path. I guess it's Fermat's principle, right?
So it basically is constructive interference.
I'm hesitating.
Okay, maybe that's just the physics way of thinking
about it. So when the Earth is 3D, then this is not completely true anymore, because you have focus and defocusing of energy, and so you have energy coming off from the sides. And the sensitivity is not just infinitesimal along the great circle path, but the to first order the propagation path is along the great circle. And so does distance, basically.
Is there a huge effect at the antipodal point when R1?
Yes,
so
of course. Yes, actually. So the next slide shows this. So this is now what we call a record section. So it's different stations as a function of time, right? Seismograms. Here, as a function of distance, this is the antipode. So this is the R1 train, and so it arrives later and later as you go, as your station is further and further away. On the other hand, R2 is arriving closer and closer, because as your station moves away from the earthquake, this path is shorter, right? So you're seeing this retrograde kind of situation. R3, which is the next one that goes around the same direction as R1, has a similar move out here, etc. But at the antipode, they both arrive together. They all arrive together. Everything arrives together, at least in the 1D spherically symmetric Earth, right? right? So you refocus. You're supposed to, I mean, ideally you would refocus everything at the end.
Does this mean there was an aftershock triggered by the
Yes, this is an aftershock, yes. This is an aftershock.
So that was adding more energy still?
Yes, it's adding energy. It's small, right, because it's two magnitudes, so it's 900 times this energy.
So are aftershocks preferentially or always that number of minutes after?
No. Oh, no. Aftershocks, there is
no... But that looks really causal.
No, there is...
Causal or not?
Well, so it is causal. That is, it's related to the main shock. Right.
But that only happens.
You have
really
a main shock
ones.
Which ruptures a rupture plane, I mean, to first order, but it doesn't rupture necessarily all of it, and so then you have aftershocks that fill in. And there are laws, you know, kind of empirical laws of aftershock, how many aftershocks you have at a particular time. You know, we have a decaying series of aftershocks.
I think Dan is asking whether it's a coincidence that that aftershock occurred essentially as the arrival of R2 and R3.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. No, no, I don't think so.
Is that
no. It's coincidental. Yeah. Okay, so, but there is, you know, there is a whole kind of area of study which looks at aftershocks triggered by the passage of surface waves, yes, and that has been observed, yes. But I don't think, you know, at least on the basis of just
one thing.
So how do you tell apart these surface waves from S waves?
Oh, so you tell them apart with different things. First of all, they contain most of the long period energy. They are dispersive, so they have a very different kind of character. I have a seismogram later on I can show you. Maybe I can fast forward to it real quick so it will become clearer. Where did I put it? So this is a three-component seismogram. So it's observation of one earthquake at one station with three components, one vertical and two horizontals, typically oriented north and east. And because of this, because both this, you know, propagation direction, which is in the great circle plane, and for body waves, it's along the ray path, we like to, the first thing you do is you rotate your horizontal components from northeast to the direction of propagation and the transverse direction. They're called radial and transverse directions. So these two horizontals have been rotated, the vertical. Here you see at the beginning you have the body waves, okay, so and then the surface waves. These are fundamental mode surface waves. The differences are in their polarization, in the frequency content, and in their polarization, frequency content, and the fact that the surface waves are dispersive in nature. The velocity depends on propagation. You can see here, you know, you can see the higher frequencies are arriving later than the lower frequencies. Okay, and this is a consequence of how they sample the Earth structure with depth, and the velocity increases with depth. The longer periods sample deeper, and so you get this dispersion.
Can you point at the longer and shorter frequencies we're talking about?
Here, okay, so each of these wiggles is like gives you a period, right? And the period here is longer than the period here, the crossing. You can see it best on this one. This is there's two types of surface waves, log waves and Rayleigh waves. Rayleigh waves are polarized in the vertical plane containing the receiver, and they have an elliptical retrograde motion. So you will observe them on the vertical component and on the radial component, which is what we see here, these two. I mean, this is the same wave, but decomposed on vertical. And then the log waves correspond to shear motion that's in the horizontal plane, perpendicular to the direction of propagation, so they appear on the transverse component. And you can see, if you've rotated your seismograms properly, and in the absence of other complications, of which there are, you should see the love waves on this component and the Rayleigh waves on this. So that's already one way to, and then the velocities, of course, the body waves travel faster, the surface waves travel slower, the love waves travel faster than the Rayleigh waves. I mean, there's all sorts of, but this is important. I put this in because that's how we will be able to locate quakes on Mars, is by observing the surface waves, we hope, and maybe some body waves, and by rotation and by you can estimate the rotation and the distance using some of these properties of propagation. So with one station, you can do a lot.
So with one station, do we isolate it to a point or a ring, or what's the? Is there a degeneracy that gives us a sort of like a swath, where it could be anywhere in that swath? Or?
Okay, so we're anticipating on. Okay, so with one station. There's other things you can do because I wanted to talk about normal modes, but let's talk about surface waves. From the arrival, the different arrivals of the different trains, you can get the distance from the earthquake. From the polarization, if you have three components, you can get where it's coming from. And so that's how you can locate an earthquake. Of course, you know, there will be errors. Because, of course, you have to assume some model to get the distance from.
But even without assuming like a core structure or something, you already get the location and depth.
Location. For the depth, it's you get the epicentral location. For the depth, it's a little more, it's a little bit more challenging. Because the best way to determine depths is by looking at depth phases, at least on the Earth, which are phases like what? So if you have, this is the surface of the Earth, let's say this is the core, you have an earthquake at a certain depth, H. What the wave, the body waves that emanate from here to some station here, you have the P wave. Let's say this is the P wave. But you also have another wave that goes first up here and then down, which is called the depth phase, little p, big P. So it's P, little p, big P. And you also have little s, big P, which is a phase that is, starts off as a shear wave and gets converted to a P wave at the surface. So this triplet of phases is important because I've exaggerated this dimension here, but typically this is close, you know, this will be tens of kilometers to 700 kilometers in the Earth. And so to first approximation, you can consider that this is a plane wave. It's seen from a distant station as a plane wave, and the two-way, the travel time difference between this wave and this wave is going to be twice the travel time over the depth of the earthquake, right? So this gives you an estimate of the depth of the earthquake. And if you have the S wave, that gives you even a better constraint because the difference in velocities between the P and the S waves. Okay? So that's the best way we can do. And so shallow earthquakes, these three phases are very close together, but for deeper earthquakes, they are well separated, and you can measure each of the travel time of each of them and then deduce the depth.
I think I just heard you say that the deepest they come is about 700 kilometers.
Yes.
So why is it that you can't have earthquakes don't happen throughout the entire mantle?
Well, we're very surprised that they do happen that deep, actually,
okay.
Because as pressure increases, the behavior of the rock should become more plastic, right? Becomes goes from brittle to plastic. So in fact, the fact that we observe earthquakes all the way down to 700 kilometers is, is something. It's a puzzle. There are some explanations, but there's no definitive. Kind of agreement on why that should happen. So the possible explanations are as they happen in subduction zones, right? So as the cold slabs goes down, you may have a sort of a wedge of metastable olivine that doesn't transform, to its higher pressure phase where it should, just because the slab is colder, and so that transformation may happen at greater depths than expected. The other explanation that have been invoked are effects of dehydration, right? That's been invoked more for the intermediate depth earthquake, which are earthquakes between 200 and 400 kilometers, but also for deep earthquakes. And what else is there? What other explanations do we have?
Anti-cracking.
It's all related to dehydration.
Since there are no earthquakes associated with plumes that near the core mantle boundary, does that put any limit on the property of plumes?
Wow. since there are no earthquakes associated with plumes, I'm just thinking, we don't know, maybe there are at the base of the mantle. Does that put any constraints on the nature of the plumes? Well, that's an interesting question. I've never had that asked before.
Silly astronomer.
Whatever's happening in the slabs caused earthquakes is not also happening in the plants, I guess.
Right.
So that dehydration and those metastable
phases? Yes, yes. A good question. I mean, we are looking for signals from the... The people are looking for signals from the core mantle boundary, and some recent studies that have looked at noise cross correlations seem to be seeing sources of vibration that may be coming from the deep mantle. So, you know, there may be things somewhere out in the future on this, but it's certainly not moonquakes, deep moonquakes, but not deep earth.
So, I'm not sure if this is getting way ahead, but could we basically do this using laser altimeters rather than traditional seismic stations?
Using laser altimeters. Oh, you mean to observe the surface waves?
Well, there's at least a vertical component. I imagine if I had one laser pointing many directions, I might could map out a large fraction of the surface response.
Okay, so they would have to be very accurate, right? Because we're talking about microns. Except near, in the near field of the earthquake, but the distance displacements are, microns. So that's. But yeah, I mean, this is something that for a very large earthquake, large Mars quake.
Are you thinking about doing it in orbit around another planet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that has been suggested for Mars. There have been papers written about this.
Static changes from earthquakes can be measured.
Yes.
Infrared.
Yeah, that's a good point.
From space-based observations.
Yes. So if you're interested in the source itself, right, in the actual earthquake or Marsquake,
displacement
you can
before and after.
During,
right? So during an earthquake, you basically have a rupture. You displace two sides of the fault, and so especially if they are shallow, right, and they displace the surface, you will see a displacement. Even if they're deeper, if the earthquake is large, you might.
There's this ionospheric effect.
Yes. There's also the ionospheric effect. Yes, absolutely. So
you can measure surface waves.
Yeah, you can measure surface waves in the ionosphere. So at the surface of the Earth, there is you have to conserve energy, right? And the density decreases very. So kinetic energy, as the waves propagate inside the Earth and couple with the atmosphere, and the actual velocity gets larger in the atmosphere, and you can pick them up in the ionosphere using GPS, satellite data, I guess. I should have thought about showing some of this, but you can very nicely follow GPS.
If I look on YouTube, will there be videos of the displacement during the earthquake?
Yes, you can use, I'm sure they can find it, yes. Okay, so, I don't know. So let me talk a little bit about normal modes.
Go back to where I was going.
Okay, so we stopped here, right? Propagation. This thing here. So if now you take a Fourier transform of a long record like this, 12 hours, 24 hours more, what you see are the peaks of the amplitude spectrum shows the peaks of the free oscillations of the Earth. And this is a record, a real record, from the very large Sumatra earthquake of 2004, which happens to be both the largest earthquakes observed in modern times with high high quality broadband seismometers. And there's a number of things you can observe here. So this is in millihertz, frequency range in millihertz. You can see the gravest modes here. This is a vertical component seismogram, so you should see there's two types of normal modes, just like there's two types of surface waves. There's the spheroidal modes and the toroidal modes. In principle, the toroidal modes you should observe only on the transverse component, so you shouldn't see them here. And these modes correspond, they're named with some indices that indicate the number of nodes in the vertical direction. This is the left one called N, and then the number of nodes on the surface, in latitude, which is this L number here. The gravest mode is 0S2, it's called the football mode. It has this kind of oscillations, it oscillates between this and this shape. A period of about 54 minutes, and then these are other modes with slightly, increasingly complex distribution of motion on the surface of the Earth. This mode here is the radio mode 0S0. It's called the breathing mode, in which the volume of the Earth just shrinks, contracts, and expands with constant radius. And if the Earth was purely spherically symmetric, for each of these modes, you would see only one line. But in fact, you observe several, and these observations from this earthquake are the first ones where you could actually see it very clearly on just one record, because the background noise is so low. But if you look at this 0S2 here, you actually see, already here, you see four lines, 1, 2, 3, 4. You should see five, because for each L, you should see 2L+1 lines. And this is splitting, like the hydrogen Zeeman effect, if you like, due to things like the rotation of the Earth and departures from sphericity, any departures from sphericity, anything that breaks the spherically symmetric symmetry. You can see these other modes, you can detect some. It's hard to see all of the lines, although I think I have some examples showing where you actually do see all the lines from this very large earthquake, because there's attenuation, which broadens the peak, the attenuation due to non-elastic effects in the Earth, and there's also, of course, finite length of record, which is governed by the fact that you can't take an infinitely long record just because of noise, background noise. You start picking it up after a while. You can see here that you can see a toroidal mode here, which is a manifestation of coupling due to mostly here to rotation from these modes.
Make a comment since we're in a planetary mode here.
Yes.
That there's one mode, possible mode, that wasn't shown. But if you had a real big impact, then you could excite it. So the inner core, which is solid and suspended in fluid, would start oscillating. And the frequency of the surface oscillation would be proportional to the density contrast between the inner and outer core, which would be very good. And also you could estimate the viscosity of the fluid in the outer core. And you could have with current seismic models, you would have a period of
4 hours.
4 hours.
With the smallest body that would have an inner core, outer core structure?
Well, I don't know. I haven't what would be the smallest, or what size impact is necessary to excite this world?
We don't know, because there's been a few sightings. There's a few papers that claim
that would be good.
Because it's a triplet, because it's an S1 mode, I guess. So you should see three lines, and so there are a couple of papers that claim that they have seen them, but it's very difficult to identify, because it also it interferes with some solar modes, so the background noise is difficult to, and also we don't know the attenuation of this mode at all, so it's not even clear what kind of methodologies to would be appropriate to apply.
So I was thinking of smashing one of Jupiter's moons or something. Mm-hmm. So the sort of how large a body do we need so that we have a solid core inside a liquid core, and then once we knew it's the smallest moons we expected the structure in.
I don't know. We should do this calculation with the present models of the Earth. How large an earthquake would you need to actually see it above?
Well, something like chips that would be good enough for us to excite it.
Yes,
but we would pay high price.
We might not be around chips.
Yes.
It depends on the precise composition of the core as well.
Would an atomic bomb be enough to
accept it? No, because atomic bombs, like the ones that, the big ones, are equivalent to large earthquakes, like we already observed. So, even in the 1960s, there were these peaceful nuclear explosions that were equivalent to magnitude 6 earthquakes. And I can't quote a number on Hiroshima, how much that was as a magnitude, but... There were bigger ones, yes.
Those are mostly exposed to the atmosphere, but if we detonated it after digging deep into
that's
ground...
Yes, so that's been done, yes. It's not allowed now, it's why you have whole networks of seismic and other infrasound and whatever to detect nuclear explosions that are being detonated that are just below the sort of background of the small earthquakes, right? Magnitude 3s and lower. So the nuclear explosions have been very useful, though, for seismologists, because they provided ground truth, right? Because you knew exactly the location and the time. So you didn't have this coupled, you decoupled the problem of the source and the structure. So they're very useful. This is another example of a few. So the other thing we could say also is, how do you know which mode is which? Okay, because these modes, of course, the frequencies depend on the internal structure, and that's why it's interesting to study them. They depend on the internal structure. The frequencies don't depend on the source. Or so if you have just one record, and you can obtain a spectrum that is be above noise level, you can identify the peaks. But then the issue is, what mode is which? Is this 0S8 or 0S9, etc. We now have sufficiently precise 1D spherically symmetric Earth models that the mode identification is not an issue for the Earth. But it could be for Mars, for example. So modes, as I said, depend on the deep structure, and so these are depth sensitivity, the kernels, you multiply, you basically, if you want to know what the frequency of the mode is for a particular perturbation in your velocity or density structure inside the Earth, you would get it by introducing a kernel, which you multiply this perturbation by to get the perturbation in the frequency. This is using perturbation theory, starting from a spherically symmetric Earth model and assuming that you have small perturbations, you work this out. And so these are, I'm showing these two because these are two very different modes, two spherical modes that have very different sensitivity to Earth structure. This one is primarily sensitive to shear velocity in the Earth's mantle. This is the core mantle boundary. And not much sensitive, not practically no sensitivity in the core, whereas this one has sensitivity to compressional velocity, which is this throughout the entire, all the way to very deep inside. This is the inner core boundary here. Very sensitive to P velocity in the outer core, and some sensitivity to shear velocity both in the mantle and in the inner core. So by measuring frequencies of different types of modes, you can get information about the distribution of shear, compressional, and density structure. So to get a density directly from seismology, really, it's really normal mode data are the most powerful, because the body waves, unless they reflect from some discontinuity, in which case the reflection coefficient depends on the impedance, which is a product of density and velocity. For the rest, you measure the travel times, don't depend on and this is how the Adam here proved that the inner core is solid, is by looking at modes that are sensitive to the structure of the inner core, and grouping them in two groups, one sensitive primarily to compression and the other one to shear. And they showed that the only way you could match the frequencies of those two groups of modes would be by having a non-zero shear velocity in the inner core. Is that a fair statement? Okay. And so, over the years, the 1D models have been built using a combination of these frequencies of normal modes and of the body wave travel times. So this is like the reference model. Also, it's still used as a reference, a pretty good reference model. There's a few little problems with it, but in general, it's a pretty good reference model. And then you confirm that with mineral physics to get at the mineralogy of the core and the mantle. I just find this so much fun. This is mode 0S3, and you can see all seven lines here from one record. This was not possible before the Sumatra earthquake 2004. Before the Sumatra earthquake 2004, you had to stack many observations to be able to extract the singlets from different modes. And for the first time, from this, the combination of very large earthquake and very high quality data, you could find them. Okay, let me move on. Okay, so then that's spherical Earth, and then of course the splitting tells you about the. I'm not going to explain, but just show you these two pictures. The splitting of the normal modes. And these are again the same two modes here, one sensitive to the mantle, one to the other. You can represent the splitting that you observe on many stations around the world and many earthquakes in a sort of map which tells you about the departure of the frequencies from the local kind of departure from of the frequencies of the modes from the reference 1D model, from the reference spherically symmetric model. And if you do this from these two modes, you see that they are very different shapes, right? So this, at each point here on this map, it's basically the integrated effect of the structure weighted by these kernels, sensitivity kernels, for this particular mode. And in this figure, if you're a seismologist or a geophysicist, you recognize very rapidly the signature of subduction zones and oceans, right? You see this 2-2 pattern, which is basically very diagnostic of structure in the mantle. And whereas this mode, which is sensitive to inner core structure, or core structure in general, has a shape which has more of a 2-0 pattern, which is an ozonal pattern, with a band of lower velocities or in the middle compared to the poles. And so this was one of the kind of arguments for basically showing that the inner core has a different, very different structure that is actually due to anisotropy, to anisotropy that then is related to the properties of iron, or the crystalline iron. So one more kind of observation, which is also in the last 20 years, this is the noise spectrum. So the noise spectrum of the Earth, so a function of frequency. There is, at the high frequency end here, around 6 seconds, there's a so-called microseismic peak. This is the peak in the noise due to coupling of the oceans with the seafloor. And then these are atmospheric effects here. And then there's a sort of notch here, which corresponds to very low noise. But it was observed that actually earlier than this, but that there seems to be some structure in the noise here, in this very low noise notch. And as so from stacking of many spectra of noise that is not excluding earthquake data, just keeping noisy days, this is a stack of 437 days without earthquakes.
This is surface motions?
So these are modes. So these are again, yes, these are surface motions. It's spectra of, you take a day of record and you compute its power spectral density spectrum.
Is it vertical or?
This is vertical. Vertical, yes. Mostly vertical. They've actually been observed on horizontal components as well, but much weaker. And what you see appear are these peaks, right, which correspond to the frequencies which are given here in dotted lines of the fundamental spheroidal modes. And so, in fact, it can be shown that you cannot get this from just summing all of the earthquakes that you may not have, removed from your. So this was sort of the discovery of the Earth's hum. The fact that in the absence of earthquakes, you actually have something is exciting through oscillations of the Earth. And it turns out it has to be near the surface because the fundamental mode is excited primarily. Fundamental mode has sensitivity close to the Earth's surface. Then it was shown that it had fluctuations, seasonal fluctuations, so different amplitudes in summer and winter, depending on the hemispheres, and finally that I guess we contributed to this by doing sort of array beamforming, that you could show that the amplitude of this noise tracked went from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere and pointed to the ocean. So the main source of these disturbances is coupling between the atmosphere, the ocean, and the ground, and the solid Earth. So the wind excites ocean waves. The ocean waves interact nonlinearly to get longer period waves, infragravity waves in the oceans, and then those are coupled to the ground to create this relatively long period noise.
So is this the waves impacting the surface, or is this something at depth at the bottom of the ocean?
It's at the bottom of the ocean, yes.
Wow, since the wind, the top.
Yes, but it's a cascade. It's a cascade of phenomena. The ocean, the wind blows and creates ocean waves that are more like 15 second period, 12 to 15 second period. And so you have to pump the energy to lower frequencies, to 200 seconds. And so it's a nonlinear interaction, which we think is interacting ocean waves. That are propagating in opposite directions will generate lower frequency infragravity waves, and these are the ones that will couple to the ground. So, but this is important, of course, if you want to study do seismology on other planets, because if you don't have any earthquakes, you still might have wind, and so the question is also. Do you need an ocean or not, right? if the wind is sufficiently strong, it might, that might be sufficient. So on the Earth, we're very happy. And I guess I've talked about the Earth. We're very happy because we have lots of sources, we have lots of stations, right? And so now, of course, I have to forget all about this. And even, you know, on the Moon, so we do have seismology on the Moon. There were five, actually, seismometers. And then Mars, we hope, will have one. So I don't know, you know, how much I can talk more, but...
I mean, why can't you land one rover and have it drop off a seismometer every, you know, few months that drives around the surface?
Ah, good question. So you can do that, but you can do that only with very robust seismometers. The kind of seismometers that we like have sensitivity to relatively long periods, right? So you can pick up the surface waves and the normal modes. They're called broadband seismometers. They're very delicate instruments. You have to install them with great care. You have to isolate them from pressure and temperature fluctuations. So dropping them, even dropping them in the oceans is not good enough. You also have to make sure that you couple them well with the ground. So dropping broadband seismometers from, you know, high is not really an option. What has been done is, you know, penetrators, so accelerometers that are more robust and that you can, you know, put in, but those will give you only high frequencies, I guess. So that's the okay, so this is Apollo Network, right? And very quickly then, you know, there's lots of sources that have been observed. So over a period of 5 to 7 years, you see there was a long period seismometer, but it was installed by hand, right? So, and they observed about 12,000 events, which range from shallow and deep moonquakes and meteoritic impacts, and then artificial impacts from just the landers, right? And then thermal cracking. Moonquakes look very different from the Earth. I mean, I don't know if you still remember the appearance of an Earth quake. The moonquakes show a much longer tail, a much longer coda than we see on the Earth. There's a lot of scattering in the moon crust, which is porous. So this doesn't make things easier because a lot of the phases that you would want to observe are obscured by these scattering effects. So we have to... Okay, these are just a lot of different statistics. What? I don't know, maybe I should stop, right? Maybe you can ask questions and I can show something.
So can you at least tell us a little bit about Mars and sort of the prospects for...
This is the moon.
How big are the moonquakes?
Excuse me?
How big are the moonquakes? What's the largest moonquake that has been reported?
I think, how do I know that? It's about magnitude 4 or something like that, equivalent to magnitude 4, something like that. Yeah, I think the largest is something like that. I don't think I have a number here.
How much energy can the earthquakes deposit in the atmosphere? You said you could see waves in the atmosphere.
It depends on the size of the earthquake. How much energy? if a typical magnitude 6 earthquake is... 10 to the, how many ergs, a typical earthquake, the moments, seismic moments, on the order of 10 to the 20 Newton meters. So if you pumped all of that energy into the atmosphere, that's what you would get. But maybe, you get less than half probably, right, if you radiate. You can get a lot of energy into the atmosphere.
But Barbara, yes. So I know that all the detectors are on the near side,
but the source of the moonquake are also on the nearby.
Yes, yes. So that's been used as an argument for saying that there has to be some kind of molten layer between, in the deep moon, that there has to be something, either
on the near side as well.
Yes, that because there's no basically attenuates the energy that is coming from the opposite side. That's
is the alternative interpretation that all the moonquakes are on the near Earth side.
Yes, but it's.
So it's tidal related.
Yes, it is tidal related.
Of course, all the seismometers were also on the other side, so
yes.
The detection capability is not symmetric.
I don't think you can...
If there is one on the far side, would it be able to detect much?
I think yes. I mean, I think if it was of the same size as the ones on this side, you probably should be able to detect it.
Should not be
able. You should be able.
Oh, should
yes.
Be.
Yes. So I think this idea that that it's hidden by some structure that is attenuating the waves is good. But of course, until you actually go there, you cannot prove that it's not related to the fact that they're all on one side. So Mars is a whole saga. Right. There was the Viking experiment, in which there was a seismometer put on a platform. And all it recorded was wind noise. So this is basically lessons learned from that experiment, is that you have to be, first of all, put it on the ground, obviously, and also shielded very. So right now, as they are working on the final stages of launching this mission, this InSight mission, a lot of effort goes into trying to estimate what kind of background noise might exist on Mars, and a lot of effort goes into designing the instruments so that it's shielded. So that it's shielded from so wind protection. So this is the design here. So this is the lander. And the seismometer is going to be deployed after landing. There's an arm here that's going to put it as far away as possible from the lander. And then it will be linked to the electronics through a cable. Right now, this is the main problem they have, is that from the calculations they're doing, is this cable may provoke some background noise on the seismometer. But they have a very cool shield here, which is a wind shield, wind and temperature shield, I guess, which has a sort of a blanket here that is expandable. So that they will.
And so they can just use wireless technology to send the data back and forth.
I think wireless technology takes, maybe I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, it takes power, doesn't it?
A little bit, but I mean, our cell phones can talk to our cars, so why not?
Good question, I'm not sure.
What's this other thing?
I think this is going to drill a hole, like to measure the temperature gradient. Probe. And there's also a magnetometer on the side. And so noise is a big deal, so there's lots of calculations. I spare you the details. And then, of course, you have to decide, what kind of sources you might get. So Mars impacts. This is an observation. And then we go back to what can you do with... I thought I had some other slides. There might be some tectonic activities. There's some evidence of landslides. And of course, you don't know. You might use that signal for source. So, but there is only one station, right? So, what can we do? So, I think I've already kind of explained a little bit what we can do, right? From the normal modes frequencies, you get some constraints on the internal structure without having to know anything else. From the surface waves, you can get the distance and the on the location of the source approximately, and therefore you'll be able to, you know, better constrain the structure also. And then if they're lucky, there will be observations of some core phases, core reflected phases, or and that, you know, phases that interact with the core, which of course will be very important to pinpoint the structure. So I think I should stop here, because you know, so they're doing all sorts of preliminary investigations to you know, to try to estimate both background noise, and of course that went into the design of the instrument to make sure that you would have enough, or that the instrument noise would be low enough to be able to detect small events, small signals. Okay.
So Barbara, with one station on Mars, or in terms of the distance and location, or how big the error bar would be?
I think I have a slide about this. Okay. This is the degrees, error location, depending on how far you are, between 10 to 15 degrees. So 10 to 15 degrees on Mars is, on Earth it's
10 degrees
is
600 kilometers on Mars.
600 kilometers.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's pretty large.
So if I did the conversion correctly in my head, which I certainly may not have sitting here, 10 to the 20 newton meters is like the amount of energy you get from the sun on Earth total over a few hours. So that's a lot.
No, that can't be right. No, no, because...
Okay, well, maybe I just did the calculation incorrectly, but I'm still going to ask the question, which is so how is it seen in the ionosphere? Do you see line emission? I mean, does it feed the ionosphere and emit line radiation?
It's the electron content. It's the...
Where does the energy go? Where does the energy go?
Where does the energy go?
Get emitted in radio waves, or you know, as those electrons spiral around magnetic fields, or what happens to the energy ultimately?
No, it's not something I looked at. So I know what it's. They're measuring the, you know, the total electron content of the ionosphere that's fluctuating in time, but. So you've got your kinetic energy, right, from the seismic waves converted to acoustic waves.
Ultimately, it'll be cooled. If it's by the electrons, it'll probably by, I don't know, synchrotron. I have no idea, but it'll be radiated away probably, unless it's conducted somewhere else in the atmosphere. I just wonder if it produces some conceivably observable in the distant future signature.
We can look it up. I don't know the answer to that. So in terms of the energy, let me try and find. I can find a, you know, slide at some point to compare the energies, but it will take me some time. But it's not that much.
Do you know whether gravitational wave detectors can be any use to seismologists? They're building, you know, extremely sensitive laser interferometers. They're trying to isolate instruments from seismic.
Yeah, they are, right. Yes.
But in measuring that or screening that, maybe they can find some useful.
Well, so yes. So just the fact that they want to isolate themselves, right? I think if I'm. From what I know, they're trying to compensate, right, for the for the seismic disturbances. So as they try to compensate, they get the information about the earthquakes, right? So so that whether or not that will be useful for detecting very small micro earthquakes, probably yes. However, these are not located anywhere near. I mean, you know, there might be some faults they're going to discover this way, you know, in the area where things is installed, but they're not installed in fault zones or active. So there could be some new information about micro seismicity coming from it.
What if instead of having just a laser altimeter shining down, if you had a laser on the surface shining up so that you could measure the phase of the light?
Oh, yes, because then you could amplify your signal, right?
Yeah. So could you do something as simple as send little drill pieces with lasers pointing in the sky when the satellites sort of are within range to...
Yeah, I think that's the problem.
Sorry?
It would be only rarely, the laser would only rarely be hitting the satellite, right?
Well, but you could track the satellite. I mean, the laser could track as the satellite went, so the direction of it would change.
And you'd be looking for the short time scale vibrations of the laser beam. Yeah. Uh-huh.
It seems much more practical to put two stations 4 kilometers apart.
But that's what the mass is. If the mass of a little laser on a
gravitational wave
thing
right.
is less, then presumably it costs less to do that than if drilling in is...
That's why fly things overhead when you can just have two
ground stations. Fly things overhead anyway. We have Mars orbiters constantly, right? So it's just a matter of outfitting it with one instrument that's...
Yeah, but Dan is saying it's a lot simpler to have two stationary objects sitting on the surface of Mars rather than some kind of station keeping and have the laser know where the satellite is and point to it. And it seems like...
You could put it like geocentric or Mars-centric orbit. It's always pointing at it.
Yeah.
You could do the moon and point them at the Earth.
Yeah, but in the end, dropping something onto the surface, that seems pretty easy.
That's not very helpful
as
a human, right? Yeah.
Why do you need a laser on?
It's not very
helpful.
Why
don't you use like a mirror or something?
Well, you divide by years.
Yes.
I don't know if it's sensitive enough, but there's a laser ranging experiment going on right now with the cubes that were dropped by the pollination. It's probably not sensitive enough.
Well, there's this millimeter type precision light. Some millimeters. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's different, of course, from gravitational wave detection, where you operate it as an interferometer, which is phase sensitive, whereas lunar laser ranging is not sensitive to phase, it's just measuring light through the time.
Is that just because we're below the atmosphere, but if we put a station in orbit, then we could be sensitive to phase?
No, it's photon starved.
There you go. Yeah.
Here we go. So, earthquakes tend to be 11 watts from the sun, 10 to the 17th, so quite far.
So then it's like 10 to the 16.
You mean 10 to the 16 going to the atmosphere? Is that what you're saying?
For a big earthquake. No, for a short time scale, big earthquake. What's the total? So that
I think this is a cumulative number.
That's all.
Well,
there must be all, but over a short time scale, you could have a big burst of energy from one earthquake. That's
so uniform.
My phone says it's 5 × 10^16 joules for an 8.2 earthquake.
Yeah. Okay.
That's true. So I just wonder if when there's a big earthquake, can you see it in the atmosphere? Does like something light up? Do you start seeing more?
Oh, lights. Seeing lights in the atmosphere?
Do those energetic electrons that you excite, you know, for a short period of time, spiral around magnetic fields and glow?
Well, there's been some, you find in the literature, some reports of lights related to earthquakes, but and it's been actually proposed to use it as an earthquake predictor, so it's different. I mean, now that's now we're talking about something different. We're talking about phenomena, you know, related to stresses before the earthquake. And
we're looking at Earth from a distance, and I don't know what the right wavelength would be, but whatever whatever wavelength you emit in the ionosphere because of this energy input, would you see bursts when there's a big, when there's a really giant earthquake? Would you see a burst, a little?
Well, you see oscillations in the ionosphere. That's certainly
probably radio. Yeah.
How would you distinguish it from like a solar wind, though?
It would be sporadic, and it wouldn't be correlated with stellar activity.
Well, you see the frequencies that you see in the earthquake, right? And you also see their arrivals. You know, they kind of arrive in a specific sequence with times.
Yeah, but if we didn't have that good data, we just saw a burst. But still, it wouldn't be correlated.
So, Ruth, you're asking this because of potential distances for galaxies.
Yeah, I mean, how are we going to see any of this from an exoplanet? We're not going to see it today. But I'm wondering, how are you going to see it if it actually makes some radio light go off in the atmosphere? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Probably not currently detectable, but it would be fun to think about whether it could be eventually.
Yeah.
Did people do anything to learn about Jupiter's core structure from Shoemaker-Levy 9?
Yes.
And so was that, what was the outcome of that?
I think it was not successful, but it was the...
Yeah, it didn't, that's right. It did not...
If it was, we would know how large the core is.
I guess the energy, it just wasn't, the amplitude of the wave was not large enough to really do anything with it.
But if we redirected comets to Uranus and Neptune, could we get them to go deep enough to reach either of their orbits?
For that, you may want to come to the next talk.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this is probably not... But if you want to know about the ionosphere atmosphere physics, I have a slide about that. If you're interested, Bruce.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.